Maybe we can start rolling the tape. My name is Molefe Tsile.
Say it again, please.
Molefe. That's the first one.
Molefe.
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 Just M-O-L-E-F-E. Molefe. And the last name is Tsile. Tsile.
Thank you.
Two syllables. And thanks for coming. I suppose you didn't have an option. Okay. the title of this lecture is on a series on justice and faith, looking at theology and the politics of struggle in South Africa. And this first lecture is really reflecting on the current transition period towards a post-apartheid South Africa. The other lectures which are going to follow are going to go a little bit back in terms of how we got to where we are. I was initially tempted to start this lecture by publicizing under the title of All You Ever Wanted to Know About What Is Happening in South Africa Today, but didn't know whom to ask, something like that. I was told that our titles must be 40 characters, so it could be about three lectures length. And also, I think the other thing was that I began slowly to get apprehensive that maybe I may not answer some of the questions. And if you say to people all that you wanted to know and then they start firing three questions, you can't answer them, that is very embarrassing. So instead of doing that, I think that I will still give you an opportunity at least to let you give you an opportunity to ask what has always been bugging you about what's happening in South Africa. And, having said this, it means that I may not answer it, but I never said all that you want to ask. You are free to do that. And the compromise position that I have is I will give a lecture where I will map out some of the central issues or challenges that I've confronted in South Africa today as it moves towards a post-apartheid society. I will specifically reflect on the specific challenges this situation has for churches. And towards the end, we will then enter into a conversation and you could then have an opportunity to pose questions. I must say that I'm not surprised that many people do not make head or tail of what's happening, because a few 2 years ago, we all received Nelson Mandela in the United States, and we all thought at least this one thing is off our agendas. And we get confused and surprised. Why do we have to be called once again to conferences about apartheid when we all thought that it's no more? And so part of that confusion is what I hope to shed some light on. Just for you to have an idea of some of the themes which will be covered by this series of lectures, which is continuing from tomorrow. As I say, today I will focus on the situation as it prevails, the current situation as it prevails, and also look forward into what is there in store, what are the promises that this have. Tomorrow I will reflect on how we got to where we are. I will revisit important sites, important milestones in the history of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. And again, focusing on how men and women of faith in that situation attempted to live their true calling to true discipleship. The third lecture, I will share this third lecture with Mudiehi, my partner in life, my wife. It's an It's a lecture that we most South Africans are struggling to share with people outside South Africa. And it's a lecture on the role of whites in the struggle against apartheid. We're going to focus mainly on the life of one great Christian. His name is Dr. Beyers Naudé, a Dutch Reformed minister, a member of the Broederbond. Naudé, he has read more than I did on his biography. So she will be able to shed more light about the major turning points in the life of this Christian. And that is going to be this lecture on the role of white South African Christians in the struggle against apartheid. And I'm saying it's of interest for Americans because to some extent there is still a problem of understanding the concept and the philosophy of non-racialism as the struggle in South Africa is all about. The fact that black South Africans do not see it as odd to elect a white person as their representatives. Many people say, for an example, in the future constitution, you need to have blacks elect their leaders and whites elect their leaders. It's going to be difficult for many blacks who have grown to respect certain white people that they would want to elect. And that is where you begin to see the philosophy of non-racialism, or whether it's an ideology of non-racialism, which is completely different. And in fact, there are other opposing ideologies, like the one represented by the Pan-Africanist Congress and the one represented by the Black Consciousness Movement, which is more closer to the American black political grouping. But all those will try to clear them in this lecture about the role of whites in the South African struggle for liberation. The final lecture will be a general reflection on Christian living or ethics with respect to the problem of the double problem of citizenship and discipleship. When you are a member of a particular group as a citizen, enjoying all that it offers, and yet at the same time have a particular calling to your other lord, and that calling may sometimes cause you to stand out against this other world to which you rightfully belong as a citizen. And basically, it's the struggle of faith and politics in South Africa. Who becomes lord when, on which issues? And you will begin to notice that it is a general problem for everybody, the clash between discipleship and citizenship. Now, reflections coming to today's lecture. Reflections on the new South Africa. South Africa of today is an interesting object of study. It has made important decisions about leaving the old behind, but it has not yet made up its mind about becoming new or what that new has to be. The result is that it slowly moves into the future whilst it obstinately clings on, or it's struggling to let go many of its past. What you have is the old living side by side with the newly born South Africa. Sometimes this old tends to suffocate, this doing things just as usual as you used to do them, calling blacks boys and so on, it tends to overshadow this willingness to move into the new. For instance, what are those things of the old that are still there? The schools, the education system in its entirety remains highly and visibly segregated. One can actually say legally segregated. The universities remain segregated, and that segregation can come either by demanding certain entrance qualifications, which it's well known that blacks do not have them. For an example, you can say that only those who are proficient with Afrikaans or Dutch may enter this university, when you fully know that blacks have been are struggling with English and their mother language. And the other form of segregation, especially in English-speaking universities, is through fees. You just double the fees that a black would pay in a more mixed university or a more predominantly black university, so that only those whose parents are doctors or so can go there. Hospitals remain segregated, including government hospitals. And in those areas where the government is pressurized to open them, the government chose to privatize them. So in the end, you can go to a mixed hospital provided we have money. Social security grants, what we call old pension grants, remains unequal. And you do know that Parliament is still an all-white affair. Not a single black person has a vote or can sit in Parliament. And of course, the government is saying, well, why do you blame us? This is why we are negotiating, what we are negotiating for. Town councils, city councils are segregated. You have black city councils in white. There is not a single black in the Johannesburg City Council or Durban City Council or Cape Town City Council. It's still all white, and with what that implies, meaning that all the taxes made in Johannesburg goes to white swimming pools, parks, libraries, and so on, and not a single cent goes to Soweto. An interesting thing is about residential areas, which we have many which are opening. And as you do know, the only way that residential areas open, learning from the history of America, is that the government moves out and then the private sector gets in and it gives a loan to a black person who is a lawyer or a doctor. And an ordinary black person applying for a loan will never get it. The security forces and the police at the top echelon of power making remain exclusively white. And finally, the churches remain segregated. I've tried to study which church has really moved to closer to integration, and the evidence seems to be that at the forefront is the Catholic Church, followed by the Anglican Church only at leadership level. The Anglican Church can employ a secretary in the head office, but not at congregational level. All the other churches, Methodist, etc., Presbyterian, Lutheran, in fact, the Lutheran is the worst of all of them, because not only does it not share one head office and so on, where the Anglican Church, we have Bishop Tutu being the Archbishop of the entire Anglican community. In the Lutherans, we still have a white German Lutheran community side by side with the black Lutheran. And I must be honest or fair to this by saying they are currently engaged in unity talks. My last visit in South Africa last year was that many people are frustrated about those talks, but they don't give up hope. Now, I think, having read all this, you'd ask me, but isn't it true that a lot has happened in South Africa? What is this man saying? Now, let me be very fair and tell you, what is it that has changed in South Africa? The beaches are open. You can now go to Durban Beach and swim. Hotels and restaurants are open. You will no longer have the embarrassment of being politely asked to leave, because this is reserved for Europeans only. Supermarket and shops no longer have separate entrances. Buses and trains are for all. And the interesting thing, obviously, with buses and trains is that you don't have a bus that goes to a particular residential area. That is a bus that goes to Sandton or Randburg. No blacks live there, so why should they take a bus going to Randburg? So you'd find that the buses, even though they are, it's open, there is always to be the people who live in that area, either mostly. A bus to Soweto, you'll never find a white person on a bus to Soweto because he has no business, at least in that understanding, doesn't stay there. The trains are open, but another interesting thing has happened with the trains in the, that is the ticket. You've got the first class and the third class coaches. So most blacks buy a third class coach, which is half the price. Not even half, really, it's cheaper. And the other people buy a first class coaches. The price is so high that an ordinary working class black will not buy that ticket. When I'm traveling with a white friend, maybe a tourist who's there, we can afford to buy a first class coach and sit together. They won't ask me. In the past, it used to be an embarrassment. If you are taking a person around, you would have to go into separate different coaches and then tell him that, listen, on the fourth station, you get off and I'll get off from my own coach, and then you meet again and go. But that is no longer happening, except that if you go to the trains, you still see white and black, except that the entrance are written first class only, third class only. Important changes is that political activism is legalized and political organizations have been unbanned. And Nelson Mandela, as you know, has been released, and prisoners have been released, exiles have been allowed to return home, the government is holding talks with representatives of blacks, and it's easier to travel or to get a passport, and there is no fear of detention. And one important change is that for the first time in the history of South Africa, up to 68% whites voted yes in a referendum. Those are important changes. Now, one of the factors in which South Africa has not only remained unchanged, but actually has even taken many, many steps backwards, it has become worse in that respect, is in the number of people dying for politically motivated reasons. Since President de Klerk took office in 1989, towards the end of 89, more than 8,000 people have died on political violence. Today, only 4 people are known to have been prosecuted for those 8,000 people who have died. One is, 4 of them are policemen. One is a white policeman, 2 were working with him, and the 4th one is another policeman who was prosecuted in a separate case and was sentenced, a long sentence of close to 20 years, and was released after 7 months. And the Minister of Law and Order said it's a computer error. He's out in the street. Ketani is his name. He's from Durban. All other accused in the murders, they go free. The police says eyewitnesses do not come forward, or that their evidence is not tight enough. The general attitude is one of a very high reluctance by the prosecutors and the state to prosecute even people who were caught red-handed and said, this is the man. He was shooting, mowing people in the train, we finally caught him, and you get shocked to hear tomorrow the police dismissing the case and say, you have no proof. There is a documented visual evidence of police standing side by side or on the side as and one organization members in Qatar organization attack residents, or police fearing them, escorting them, and still the police says, well, it cannot help with this violence. The government has refused calls for groups to be disarmed especially in public rallies, to ban the carrying of weapons, spears and so on. The government says, well, it's a cultural thing. If I can tell you about the carrying of weapons in South Africa, you'll get shocked. That in South Africa, it was illegal for a black person to carry a hunting knife, an okapi, a Swiss knife. It was illegal. And that became illegal because in the 60s, blacks developed the habit of sneak attack and just snap attack step a person in town. And one of the people who was stabbed to death was the former prime ministers or president of South Africa, Dr. Verwoerd, in 67, I think. And that's when the carrying of pocket knives was banned. But today the government says it cannot ban spears. In Johannesburg, carrying a spear, because it says it's a cultural. It's very, very clear that this has nothing to do with the any cultural laws. No mention is made that South Africa has one of the strongest police force, and that it is capable with that force to bring order in the most unorderly situation, as we have seen in 1985-86. In this instance, it's clear that the government has just deliberately chosen not to use that power it has. Let me give you an example of what Bishop Tutu said to a team of World Council of Churches which was visiting South Africa early this year. He said in Cape Town to this group, it's incredible, that is, I quote, the police who could ferret out people brought into the country secretly, who knew whom you were speaking to. A very, very efficient intelligence system they had. Who could give you the chapter and verse of what you said in a particular meeting. Now suddenly become so inept that even when they are on the scene, people have the opportunity to shoot and kill without being arrested. This is how suddenly this police force has become so powerless. It's hard to believe for people who have suffered under that police system that it can be like that. Another thing that most of the victims are non-members of any political organization, not even active, not card-carrying members, that they are just chosen randomly. For an example, 50% of the 8,000 people who have died are Zulus, who died in the Natal, Pietermaritzburg area. That most of them are women and children. That the government has not used any of its powers to pursue, investigate, prosecute, or just gather information that it is, follow-up information that has been given about planned attacks. Sometimes people would hear that there's going to be an attack and then they would then inform the police, and we understand that this area is going to be attacked, and the police says, oh, you know, we cannot do anything until something happens. Or they say, we cannot arrest anybody because he has not yet done anything. We have had defectors from the police, some of them white, who have gone out in public and said, we did this, and the government says, we don't know anything. Some of the major exposé of police collusion with killers have been publicized in major newspapers in South Africa, but up to today, the government of Mr. de Klerk is still reluctant to accept responsibility. And finally, that I want to say this so that you can begin to understand the context in which South Africans are beginning to look at this problem. That not a single white person since 1990s have been a victim of political violence. In other words, this thing is continuing like this because not a single white person has died. And this leads many people to begin to say, what do you expect de Klerk to do? Because the white people do not feel this. That is not happening in their community. Now, all this, I've just said, this is the situation today. What is the role of the church in this situation? And I said that the purpose of my lecture is to begin to reflect what are the challenges of the role. My view is that the role of the church will be determined by how they see the situation. If they see the situation as one that has improved and much better, the church will begin to respond like that. And my opinion about the situation, unfortunately, is that it is worse than before Mr. de Klerk came into power. Just by calculating the number of deaths, the situation is worse. Earlier, we spoke of the kairos in South Africa, the moment of challenge in South Africa, and I believe that actually today is the kairos in South Africa. It is very fashionable for those who want to be politically correct in South African speaking to say apartheid is dead. But I think that one needs to be more theologically correct and say justice is far from being a fact of life in South Africa today. One of the unpopular things you can do in South Africa today is to talk about the past. If you want to be politically incorrect, just try to talk about the past. Try to talk about apartheid. People will be very impatient with you. They will say you live in the past. This is what ministers are saying. You live in the past, the problem with you. I've seen television debates when somebody tried to remind the minister, Mr. Minister, but you are the person who voted for this law in 1980. You say, oh, the problem is you, is that you are locked up in the past. Don't you see that it's a new South Africa now? Don't you see that the situation has changed? And that you are old-fashioned. And actually, as I say this, I think that the same mood is prevalent even in America. In my talks and moving around, I've seen people are impatient with anybody who talks about South Africa as if that problem is not yet over. It looks our human capacity to believe that we have failed on this issue is such an embarrassment that people don't want to accept it. They just say it's over. We cannot be, this problem cannot be so insolvable for a highly intelligent people of today. And some people who have worked tirelessly against apartheid, I've spoken to them at the ELCA, and they would say to me, Mr. Reverend Zele, but surely you must give Mr. de Klerk the benefit of doubt. Surely he cannot be that bad. Oh, but he's such a nice person. Have you seen him on Ted Koppel? Oh, but surely he's different from his predecessor, Mr. Botha, etc., etc. It looks as if people need it. They need a changed South African leader. They want to believe that he's different. And you can come with all the evidence and say to them, do you know who Mr. de Klerk is? Do you know when he started becoming a politician? Do you know anything? They don't want to know all those things. All that they know is that here is a savior who must be rewarded. And the rewarding language, obviously, is the language of your president. Now, this, therefore, is the challenge of the church. To say what justice today in South Africa requires vis-a-vis that what is the popular line, what is politically correct in mass media, in acceptable circles. The phrase New South Africa is a theologically loaded phrase. It entails a lot. It entails rebirth, it entails renewal, it entails repentance of old wrongs. But South Africa, strangely enough, wants to become new without abandoning the old. And this is what the church has a challenge to point out and to refuse to accept. The new South Africa cannot be built unless there is willingness to forgive, forget, and reconcile. And these words, I've deliberately chosen them. But there can be no forgiving, forgetting, and reconciliation as long as the others hold on to the ways of old. More so, especially as long as those ways of old have proven to be deadlier. You see, in the past, some people asked me when I was going to South Africa, what do we fear most? I said to them, I've got this strange feeling of having to enter through John Smart Airport and not be arrested. That's a strange feeling of entering without arrested. And I said to people, but you know what? I'm afraid of getting into a train because I may not be alive. I'm afraid of taking a public bus because I may not be alive. And so this is, people used to be afraid of being taken by the police and being detained. Now, that was much better than what people have got to stay with today, which is the fear of simply being eliminated. So politically, it may be desirable in South Africa to appear to be somebody who is reconciliatory. But I think theologically, we need a Jeremiah who will say this is not new, and who will stubbornly refuse to bite the popular line and fall to the temptation of being acceptable person. Let me pause here and begin to entertain your questions.
How many factions are there that are competing for prominence in the political system? Is it a two-sided thing? ANC on one side and the old government headed by de Klerk on the other? What are we talking about in South Africa?
In terms of, if the opinion polls are to be reliable, it's a two-side thing of Mr. de Klerk Nationalist Party and Mr. Mandela's African National Congress. There are many middle players, and depending on their strength and powers, the most prominent of which is Chief Buthelezi, who, according to opinion polls, depending on how you read them, would actually receive about the same as other political organizations like the Pan-Africanist Congress that I spoke about, which means maybe pulling a little below 10% of the population each. But the recent poll it seemed to indicate that the African National Congress is likely to get at least 60% of the vote. It is possible it can get 65%. And Mr. de Klerk can easily get 30%. And there are that many groups in the middle can get the rest. Mm-hmm.
I had the sense that there were four or five groups that were competing, and within the black entity, there was at least three that were vying for prominence, for leadership.
You could say so. Within the black community, they are major. Those are not just in terms of their positions, platforms. There is the platform which is associated with those groups that worked, one can say, within the system. That is the language in South Africa. That is those who were part of self-governing states. That is the lead, the Bophuthatswana, Tswana, which is where Sun City is, and many other homeland leaders. Then there is the African National Congress. And then on the other side, which is normally called the left, there is what is called the Pan-Africanist Congress, yeah, together with the Azanian People's Organization, which takes the position that white people should not be part of the black political movements in terms of solving problems.
I'm so GI, I have them labeled as the AK-47s, the Spears, and the others.
Yes.
Do you think it would be possible if they had a split government? I don't understand how that could work. I mean, it would just be like two different countries, wouldn't it? How could they have a black political leaders and then white political leaders voted by each particular race?
You are right. I think that is part of the debate now as to how can you have a single government with two voters' role, where there is a voters register for whites and a voters register for blacks. And that is why it doesn't make sense to many people, and everybody say you must have a single voters register. But then the problem is that once you have a single voters register, the reality of the numbers is that we've got a 36 million today, and the projection according to numbers, but in about 6 years' time, this is likely to be about 48 million to 50. Now let me show you how it's broken. It's about 5.5 wide, and you have 30.5 blacks. Now this blacks, as you know, includes three groups, which is the so-called Africans, people of Indian origin, and the so-called colors. These are people of mixed blood. Now, of this, the Indians is 1.5, the colors is 2 point something, and then the rest are Africans, okay? Put them at 27. Now, the politics of numbers tell you that it will be difficult for this group to get a majority if it votes as a group. It will just be difficult. I can just think that, assuming they are able to buy a few of these, the likelihood is that this group, by 1.2, will vote with whites. 1.2 of them will vote with. That is we've got a very conservative Indian community, which is business people and so on. Majority of them will vote with whites. So you can say, okay, it goes there, and then you have a not. Depending on how you view this, this is a constituency where Dr. Alan Busak comes from. It is highly politicized in certain areas, especially the Cape. Not so well politicized in areas such as the Transvaal around Johannesburg. But then if you give it the benefit of doubt and say it splits even, you can still have about 10 million of these people voting with a gay. Now, still, it doesn't come nearer. So that the realities of the situation in terms of numbers is such that there is this fear that no matter how you can do it, no matter what you can say, you're going to have a black government, so to say, in terms of majority. And this is where the debate is. Hence, you see when they talk about Mr. Mandela initially offering 65% passing the constitution must be passed by 65%, and then the Klerk says no, it must be 75%. Then the last talks which were held, Mandela said, okay, fine, if you are not happy with 65, because the ANC said 65 deliberately because it at least knew that it has 65% of the support in the country. They said, okay, let's make it 70, and that's where it broke down. The Klerk says no ways, it must be 75, because at least the Klerk knows that he can have about 26% of the vote to can veto and make sure that nothing passes. And which means if he has all these people, he can at least take about a million rands or dollars and use it in one African bloc constituency and say, please, you'll get hospitals and everything, just vote with us in this time so that we can control, even if he moves this thing. But then he can at least. Now, many people are simply saying, you give in to 75, we move out. And that is where the debate is now. That is the politics of numbers.
So the population is going to be 48 million in 6 years?
Yes. And where
and are you coming from? That's huge.
And an interesting thing is that of this 48 million, the increase of white community in this projected increase is going to move from 5.5 to about less than 6 million. Actually, the entire increase, one can say, is basically going to be in this group.
So from immigration from other parts of Africa?
No. Not immigration, just within. And that is one of the problems why there is a negative growth in whites, is that they are moving out, Australia, New Zealand, etc. Although not in that numbers now. And I think possibly those projections were made at the time when they were moving in large numbers, so maybe it may be a little bit different. But we are talking of blacks, projected growth of blacks inside South Africa. It's It's growing at such high level of numbers. I mean, cities are growing in an uncontrollable manner. Every four years, the entire landscape has changed.
Can the economy begin to support this kind of growth?
Fortunately, South Africa is capable. It has one of the strongest economy, infrastructure, linking, and so on. It can easily dominate the entire of Africa, at least the entire sub-Saharan Africa. Definitely can dominate it, can supply, can be the heartbeat of that continent. As soon as the politics get all right, it's not heavily populated. It's a big country. If we talk of 30 million, you still talk of, in terms of comparisons with Britain, Germany, and so on, very few. And it has big industries. So in terms of, there is potential, but obviously in terms of planning, building houses, etc., you still need to control that. But it's not as scary as if suddenly, maybe it's like Tokyo, where suddenly there will be no space for houses. We don't have that problem at that level.
More jobs and water and things like this.
So yeah, that's why I say in terms of jobs, the demand of goods from South Africa can easily make jobs a lot, many of them available. I mean, if you look at all these places in from Zaire down Zambia, there is not a single car manufacturing plant, and all these car manufacturing plants are in South Africa in terms of Ford, Toyota, Chevrolet, Volkswagen, and so on. So there is no problem with jobs if the politics get okay. It will be cheaper for many, even Japanese companies to do their things in South Africa and then supply the rest of Africa. It has more universities than, we've got 22 universities. And as far as I remember, maybe Ghana or Nigeria has about 2 and so on. And some of the universities, University of Cape Town, Vets, I mean the medical school of those universities, got the doctors working at the University of Chicago trained at South African medical universities.
Has the presence of the foreign corporations helped or hindered the process?
In some respect, it has helped the process, mainly because the economy tended to become dependent on foreign relations. And at the time when there were threats of disinvestments, South Africa really began to respond to that pressure. It is a well-known fact that the South African legislation was made in such a way that it was an incentive for foreign corporations to come to South Africa. For example, South Africa had banned unionization of African workers, and that in itself meant that they won't be union, they won't bargain. But and also the taxation system was such that South Africa used a lot of these foreign corporations for its own security activities. But later, when there was that pressure happening, they started to become more responsible. And the situation we have today, definitely foreign corporations have a positive role. They are well respected. They've got a power in South Africa. The South African government knows that if it can move, it cannot be hostile to them because the whole economy will go. And an interesting thing is that the highest disinvestor in South Africa today are South African corporations. Mining houses. Have you ever heard of the word DPS?
Yeah.
DPS Diamond, you know that it's major insurance and so on, it's in the US today. It's disinvesting from South Africa. And I'm thinking of many other big names. Anglo American is buying a lot of offshore development in many of resort areas in the US. Those are South African corporations, which were mainly built on mineral resource exploitation, that is a chamber of mining.
Like I was struck by your comment at the beginning about how you sense that when Nelson Mandela came to this country and there was a big welcoming of him being here, that there was, within the American public at least, kind of a sense that things were perhaps over, or that there had been major steps taken in ending apartheid. And I think that what comes to my mind when you said that was that after Mandela returned to South Africa, I can remember on the New York Times there being this picture of he and de Klerk together, actually, you know, having their hands held together up in the air, and there was a sense that de Klerk was actually going to utilize Nelson Mandela for kind of a political advisor of some sort at that time. And I think what I'd like to know is what your perception of the American media is in their reporting of South African business and politics and affairs. I mean, you've been in this country for a few years, and you probably had a lot of opportunities to see how the media in this country has portrayed the struggle, and to know what your response or your reaction is to that.
Well, coming from Chicago, the Chicago Tribune is one of the worst
in
reporting. It has a line that it takes, and you can phone them, you can ask them that, please, this line is not correct. You can do everything. And their line of reporting is that de Klerk is doing his best. These two factions, black on black, the tribal wars are just killing one another, and then don't blame it on de Klerk. And every time they write anything about South Africa, they always say the chief Buthelezi's Inkatha Freedom Party and its rival African National Congress, and then they will say the ANC has always said that has always accused the security forces, but the accusations have never been proven. You see, and then you can the Guardian has published this, which says it's the death squads scandals in de Klerk's regime. British newspapers are more saying the truth. And all these things are not reported, or even they are in the wires, but they're not reported in American media. There is a slight change in the New York Times because there is a new South African correspondent. Mm-hmm. The previous one was Christopher Wren, W-R-E-N. Mm-hmm. The new one, Killer, is much better in terms of his mail, very informed. So the American media on the whole, including television broadcasting, is bad. You cannot know anything if you rely on that.
You talk a little bit about the the roots of black-on-black violence in South Africa. Seems like, especially lately, we hear horrific numbers of people being killed, and it seems like it's not at least overtly done white-on-black. It's mostly done intertribal or something like that.
Yeah, the roots are simply that it's political. There are African leaders who work with the de Klerk government or with the Nationalist Party. They are scared about change, because basically change means their power will be eroded. They had a lot of power which they were given by Pretoria, and that power was awarding contracts, employing, promoting, and running the departments. For example, Chief Buthelezi is the Minister of Police in his region, and he gets his budget from Pretoria. He has the education department which runs schools, which runs teachers' colleges, which employ and promote teachers. There is a political patronage and power. And once there is a pure democratization, that you become a leader if you are voted by the majority of people, that it's threatening for some of these people. And therefore they are resisting going into the future. They are more happier with the situation where you've got white people or de Klerk there, who gives them little kingdoms for them to rule over. And a new South Africa will mean that those kingdoms are no longer there. And that's where there is this resistance. And this resistance has always been there, it's in my memory, since 1970s. Then it just was there, it was a fact. People knew that, you should realize that there are about how many groups who operate just like that, about eight others, tribal groups. It just by coincidence happened that this one group, that is the of Inkatha, is the only one that is involved in violence, and people have to ask questions why. Why doesn't the Mangope government do the same thing, or the Zanwisi government, or the Gozo government in Ciskei, and so on? Why only one group? And so it shows that it has nothing to do with tribal thing. It has to do with politicians who make. I can tell you, if there could be a new set of politicians in KwaZulu with a new mind, they will simply, like other people, resist in ways that other people are resisting. Now, but if you look at Chief Buthelezi, he's a different person. Chief Buthelezi is the only African leader who has access to the White House. He was in the US the 2 weeks ago, touring. He's the only leader who has access with the number 10 Downing Street. So it becomes an ideological thing. He is not just a leader, but he represents a certain line. He represents European interest, white interest, free enterprise, more conservative, Republican, right wing, or whatever, a mixture of all those, including a protection of certain undecided white South Africans, those liberals from the English-speaking community, who think that Mandela may be a communist, it's better. Buthelezi is old-fashioned, and Buthelezi is hard on his people, that is on Africans. It's very, very hard. So you see, this is the part, that ideology. I see it not so much as a tribal or black, it's an ideological thing. It could have been any other person representing that ideology.
I had a question about homeland. Can you explain how that system works? Is it within or outside or what?
Yeah, I'm not surprised that you are confused. Everybody is confused, even South Africans. Homelands just never made sense. I was born in Johannesburg. My mother is North Sotho, my father is Tswana. And then the government just decided that every black person, as long as he's in Africa, must have a homeland somewhere. He cannot come from Johannesburg. That was the ideology. In other words, you cannot come from white South Africa. You must be coming from the rural area somewhere. And so they just sat and said, who's your father? If you say Tswana, they say, oh, so he's closer to Botswana. Your homeland is Maputa, Tswana. Who's your father? So-and-so, or he's closer to Xhosa. Your homeland is Transkei. You may never have known that place. Your grandfather may never have known it, and all those confusion, but then you'll be just given citizenship of that, as long as that citizenship is not part of South Africa. That is white South Africa.
But then do you carry a South African passport?
Yeah, well, things changed, because the whole thing was not working. I was not allowed a passport for many, many years. I was given a travel document if I had to travel. I traveled Europe with a travel document. And my travel document was written nationality Tswana, because I'm not a South African. It changed in 1989 when I first got my passport, and then I was given a South African passport. So it was when they were beginning to see that policy of homeland is not going to work, and then they were beginning to bring all these people who go to back to South African citizenship. And in fact, it was trained there to say, before you get a South African passport, you must renounce your citizenship of this other homeland, even if you never voted or stayed there. Now, let me just, if there is anybody who has a question, if you can entertain one final question.
This is a small question, but in relationship to the harbor in Namibia that South Africa has possession of, would that change with the new South Africa?
There is no doubt that the ANC is doesn't want to own that harbor. The position of the ANC is that if we can solve it, our problem, we'll just have a ceremony and hand over the harbor to Namibia, because it's a Namibian harbor. I mean, yeah. It does not make sense to say Walvis Bay is South Africa when everybody knows it is Namibia, just for economic reasons and to further destabilize Namibia that the South Africa clings on. And I think Namibians have realized that South Africa is not going to negotiate Walvis Bay with them. So their hope is that the new government can come in, and it can happen just automatically. Now, just to conclude this, as I say, we'll have other opportunities to share some of these intricacies. But there is one thing that I'm going to appeal. Tomorrow in the resource center, there will be a set of letters that I will ask you and your friends to write. They're very simple. All of them are expressing concern that there is violence going on in South Africa, and I request that you communicate that, number one, with the leadership of the ELCA, again, to remember that situation by the ways in which they've done in the past, contacting the Washington and so on. The second letter is written directly to President Bush. The third letter is written to presidential candidates, Ross Perot, Bill Clinton, asking them to say something about what's happening in South Africa. And the final letter is written to both Congress representatives and senators. There is a resolution S301, which has been co-sponsored by Kennedy, Paul Simon Kennedy, and somebody else that I've forgotten. We request that you ask your representatives to familiarize themselves with that resolution and lend their support. Basically, the resolution is to the effect that the U.S. must urge an investigation of the violence in South Africa and begin to tie its policy towards South Africa to the resolution of the violence going on. There is clear evidence that that violence is state-sponsored. And until the U.S. says it is concerned about that, it will never end. And next time we can sit here and say, since the last time we met, 4,000 more have died. Just a personal biographical note about where I am. I'm in a very unsettled position sitting in the U.S. knowing people are dying at home. I've had meetings with many South Africans to discuss what must we do. And I've said to them, I feel as if it's immoral for me to sit in Chicago and do my doctorate when I know that the situation is bad. Especially if I describe the situation as worse than in the past when we went to prison and so on. I have an option. My option is to use my stay in the U.S. to help popularize, to help make people see what is happening. And if I can do that, I'll be happy that I used my stay here better than if I was in South Africa. If I go to South Africa, most of the things we will do in any way would be to appeal to people we know from America to say, do say something to your Congress, because American government, as you will hear today when we speak in the forum, has so much power if only it can choose to use it correctly and ethically. Unfortunately, most of the time it doesn't choose like that. And therefore my appeal is that I'm not sure about the hour, but it will be announced. Even those people who are not in here today, we will try to appeal to them. There is an action alert on the violence in South Africa. You know that the talks have collapsed ANC after the massacre last week, where more than 40 people were killed, most of them women and children. And this whole goes to show this has nothing to do with tribal, and it was not known whether these people are Zulus or what. All of them were not even ANC members. They were just ordinary people. And the people who are the receiving end in the killings today in South Africa are unfortunately really the most poorest of the poor. People who don't even have a house, who try to make a living by being a chef, and they get attacked. There is a reason why that happens. The government tries to use these tactics of terror to keep people out of the towns. And so these are people who are desperate in the rural areas. They try to come to the urban areas. Then suddenly an imp of 200 people escorted by police bend down their shacks and the little they have. And this is an issue that I say it's more serious than in the past. You know, I wouldn't have had any shred of anything if I get arrested, because I knew why I was arrested. I was an activist and I consciously took that decision. But it's a different thing if a mother, a child who knows nothing, has never voted or discussed anything, simply get a spear for nothing, really, absolutely nothing. And it is so painful. And I'm resisting to say that what would de Klerk do if those 40 people had been innocent white people? Or what would have the world done if it had been like that? And those are some of the issues that we as Christians begin to look into. So there is that action alert. I'm going to be together with some other South Africans appealing to the ELCA bishops. We're going to be doing that. We're going to take this thing very, very seriously. We knew that sanctions were lifted by Washington prematurely, and we said that